It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at what issues state legislators are looking to take up in the next session.
First, a new study out this week takes a look at the relationship between brain function and shift work, otherwise known as any kind of employment that falls outside of the traditional 9-to-5 work schedule.
The study found that shift work can actually dull the brain over time. The impairment was worse in those workers who've been doing it for longer periods of time.
Joining us now to talk about the results and what we know about how shift work affects the body is Christopher Colwell. He's a professor of psychiatry and director of the Laboratory for Circadian and Sleep Medicine at University of California, Los Angeles. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So specifically, what did this study find out about how shift work might be affecting the brain?
Okay. Well, it followed a large group of around 3,000 French workers, about half of whom worked in a regular 9-to-5 sort of schedule. The other half worked mostly the night shift, you know, working during the nighttime when your body would rather be sleeping. And they basically did a series of tests of their ability to learn and remember, looking, you know, 1 year after they had started the night shift, 5 years after, and 10 years after. By the end of it, they were able to document that there was a significant decline in the ability of people to learn and remember on a different set of tasks. So they found that by the end, you know, the sort of decline that you would get after 10 years of the shift work was equivalent to maybe about like 4 or 5 years of the sort of normal aging-related decline in these memory tasks.
And was it reversible?
Well, luckily, it was, although it took longer than you would hope, that they did find that you got back to normal after about 5 years.
And were there differences, you know, based, again, on the amount of time someone did shift work?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, work from this study and others, you know, I mean, if you have to, you know, if you're working shifts occasionally, this is not something you have to worry about. This is more for those individuals that are sort of chronically working the night shift or a swing shift at their local factory, or even, you know, of course, healthcare workers are very common night shift workers in American culture anyway.
Now, this is something that obviously was evidenced enough to show up in a study. Is it enough that it would affect you in your day-to-day life?
Yes, you know, this study, so this was looking at a large group of people, and, you know, if you just looked at this in and of itself, you'd say, okay, that's interesting, but, you know, certainly nothing to be worried about. But it does fit with sort of a whole body of literature, which is just starting to be uncovered, really, over the last few years, that looking at, for example, individuals that are flight attendants. You know, they've done these sort of memory tasks on those that are working sort of regular, where they're doing local travel, versus those that do transatlantic. Same sort of results. Those that do the transatlantic flights have higher levels of cortisol, the stress hormone, and their performance and vigilance type tasks goes down. Likewise, in the laboratory, you can take people and rather quickly show that if you disrupt their sleep-wake cycle, their performance goes down. And finally, you know, there's a variety of studies in laboratory animals that show exactly the same thing. So it's not just something about our culture or whatever. It's really part of the biology that if you disrupt the sleep-wake cycle, you disrupt, especially memory seems to be very vulnerable to this.
As someone who studies sleep and sleep medicine, was this surprising to you?
No, not at all. Because of all these different studies coming up, the findings were what we would have predicted. Although, you know, I don't want to take anything away from this study, because I mean, this was, you know, as you can imagine, you know, decades worth of work, and so it's important that you get this sort of epidemiology information about the populations. In some ways, you know, I think of shift workers, you know, as canaries in the coal mine. All of us in our, you know, modern society are experiencing a lot of disruptions in our sleep-wake cycle. But it's those individuals that are doing this day in and day out that are sort of at greatest risk for the ill effects of shift work, you know, of jet lag and the circadian disruption. And this study shows the cognitive dysfunction, but there's also work that's strong evidence is showing an increased risk for type 2 diabetes and even an increased risk for certain cancers. A group at Harvard has been studying nurses, these Woman Health Initiative, where they've hundreds of thousands of American nurses that they followed for many years, decades now, and those that work shift have an increased risk for breast cancer. So it seems that it's consistent. You know, this is just sort of the latest piece of information in this body of work.
So specifically, why do you think that this is? What do we think is behind these results
right.
that we're seeing?
Right. So it's harder to know in humans themselves because, you know, we can't get in and, you know, there's a lot of limitations in what we can do. And in animal models, though, you can actually look at the mechanisms that underlie learning and memory processes in the brain. And it turns out that when we sleep, okay, animals and humans, that this is when a lot of processing takes place in our brain, and some things get stored as long-term memories, some things get dumped out as things you don't need to remember. And there's a sensitive phase. And if you disrupt sleep during that time, you disrupt this storage of memory. So, for example, in experimental animals, we can show that even something is innocuous, it's just having the mice eat at the wrong time of day, so eat when they should normally be sleeping, actually completely interferes with their ability to remember tasks that they could normally learn and remember very simply. So there's really something fundamental to the biology, which is something that then we have to be careful of when we're working these sort of night shifts.
So you're talking about the disruption of sleep as being a major factor in what's happening here, but if someone, say, is very regimented about sleeping that
right.
consolidated 8 hours of sleep, only they do it during the day rather than at the night, are they still going to see results like these?
Yeah, that's a great question. We don't know the answer to that for sure, but again, based on our results with experimental animals, we believe that if you could adjust to a night shift, if you were successfully able to just completely shift to that schedule, you know, which is hard if you're working nights, but it is possible. In the same way that if you're traveling to Europe or something, you know, you can adjust to the new time zone in Paris, but it takes you a couple of weeks. What's most disruptive is the rapidly shifting back and forth. So if you think about it, people that are working the night shift, you know, they may do that for 3 or 4 days a week. And if they completely shift back into the day for the other days, they're basically, it's like traveling to Europe and back, you know, a couple times a week. Mm. So it's very disruptive for the biological clock, and that produces the worst outcome. So we believe that individuals that kept a regular schedule, okay, even if it was one that was different than most people, that they would be able to handle this without these difficulties.
Does the daylight itself, or on the flip side, the darkness itself, have anything to do with this?
Yeah, that's another great question. So our central clock is in our brain, and it's very sensitive to sunlight. In particular, it turns out it pays attention to blue wavelength light. So normally this works fine, right? So you get up in the morning, you're exposed to sunlight, blue light, and it synchronizes to that. It uses that as the signal that the day has started. And then it uses that information to communicate to sort of clockwork found throughout your body. So your heart and your lungs and your liver, everything is all synchronized by this central clock in the brain. And the main cue that we use is sunlight. And this has big implications, you know, given that so many of us are working inside under conditions where we're under fluorescent lights, which don't have a lot of blue wavelengths, are not very good at shifting this clock. And likewise, many of us play, video games or are on tablets during the night, which have a lot of blue wavelength light. So your body's clock basically follows the light. And we see that a lot with young people, that they'll start having disruptions in their sleep-wake cycle because they're on electronic devices at the night, and then during the day they're in the classroom under fluorescent light. So basically they're in sort of an inverted light-dark cycle. So this is something that we see a lot, especially young people.
We're talking with sleep expert Chris Colwell right now about the results of a new study on shift work, like working the night shift, and brain function, and showing that shift workers tend to have decreased brain function, according to a new study. And we'd like to hear from you on this.
Do you work unusual hours at your job? Have you ever worked the night shift? Do you feel like it takes a toll on your health, on your thinking, your brain function? How do you make sure you get enough sleep? How do you try to split the difference there? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up that conversation in just a moment, but first, here's a look at some of the latest news with Kristen Durst. We're talking about the results of a new study that looks at how working non-traditional hours, like the night shift, can take a toll on brain function over the long term. And you can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our guest is Christopher Colwell. He's a professor of psychiatry and director of the Laboratory for Circadian and Sleep Medicine at the University of California, Los Angeles. And we'll take our first call now. Phil joins us in Madison. Hi, Phil.
Hi.
Hi, what do you think?
Well, I just turned on the radio and just started picking up on this, and it was kind of interesting because I spent 26 years on the third shift. And for the last 11, 12 years, I've been on a day shift. So it was tough, raising a young family. My wife was awesome. She made sure that I got my sleep and stuff like that. So, but yeah, it was kind of weird trying to flip back and forth on weekends and try to fit in the family functions and
do all that stuff. When you were in that 26 years as a night shift worker, did you feel that it was taking a toll, maybe on the way that you process things or your memory?
Yeah. I know. I was reminded all the time that. I was forgetting things, and so I was pretty good with the post-it notes. That helped a lot.
Does it feel like you're back
like
to normal?
My wife, yeah. It only took me a week to feel good about coming on to a day shift, and I fit right into that, easy as heck. So,
okay.
Like I said, my wife was wonderful on all that. She made sure I got my sleep. She kept me informed what was going on in our lives and. So, yeah.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for sharing your story, Phil. Phil had a lot of help, it sounds like, from his wife. He tried to be regimented. Is that the right way to do it if you're a night shift worker?
Yes, it's... I mean, Phil's story is something that we hear all the time, you know, so I would recommend that someone stick, if they have to work a night shift, that they stick on those hours. But the thing which people tell me more and more, you know, the problem is that how then do they see their family, right? How do they make time to be with their loved ones? And that's what drives people to shift back and forth. So if you have an understanding spouse that, you know, or caregiver who can help you, you know, sort of when you do have to sort of keep on a regular schedule to get enough sleep, to eat at the appropriate time, so this will definitely make it more possible to work a night shift without having the negative consequences that we're talking about here.
All right. Well, thank you for that call. And we go next to Stevie in Milwaukee. Hi, Stevie.
Hi.
What is your experience with this?
Well, I the times when I was a third shift worker, I felt like I was finally on my right schedule. I recently came back to first shift, and honestly, I've been miserable. I prefer sleeping in the morning. I like sleeping in the afternoons. And I've found that it's harder for me. So I guess my question was, is it possible that some people are really just geared to be awake at night?
Well, that's an interesting question. Thank you, Stevie. Yeah. Is that true? Is it possible?
Yeah, that's a great point that Stevie brings up. It's the people have there's differences in individuals in terms of the timing of their sleep-wake cycle. And there are just people that are naturally night owls, and there's even a biological basis for that we can measure genetically. And for those people, in fact, yeah, the morning shift can be the most disruptive. And, you know, getting up and, you know, at 6 to get into work early can be much more disruptive than staying up late. And I believe, in fact, for a lot of the night shift workers, they're sort of self-selected in that way, that there's some people that try it, and really within a week or two, they know that they just can't possibly do it, where others sort of seem to gravitate toward it for whatever reasons. It's very adaptive. And I think that's part of the reason that, in fact, these deficits are not as dramatic. I think they would be more dramatic, you know, the memory deficits, if we just took everyone, the general population, and had them work a night shift for 2 weeks. Most people would not be able to handle it, I believe.
How do you know which one you are, which your body is best suited for? Do you just go by feel?
Yes, I think so. You know, there are sort of, as I mentioned, genetic tests for it, but more or less most of us know whether we're a morning person or a night person, right? And so it's the people that are naturally the night people that will do best during the night shift, and the morning people should really stay away from that. Of course, you know, the bodies do adapt to it, but as Stevie relates in her story, you know, she feels most comfortable working the nights, and those are the people that are ideal for working the night shift.
Well, thank you, Stevie, for the call. And I'm going to go to Tim in Brule. Hi, Tim.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. You know, I did third shift for several years doing security in Minneapolis. And I worked in down the hole where I never saw daylight. Yeah. And it was one of the toughest jobs I ever had. And I usually had to drink caffeine all through the night in order to stay awake, and then have to take sleeping pills once I got home in order to fall asleep while the daylight's coming in through my windows.
Wow. Well, thank you, Tim. That sounds like a rough go of it for Tim. What sort of advice would you have for someone who is in a situation where that's their reality, that's their job, and they have to make good with it somehow?
Right. Well, I mean, I think Tim's story brings up a good point that, you know, what you would want to avoid if you're trying to sleep, you know, so if you've just been coming off of a night shift, you want to try to limit your exposure to the blue sunlight to minimize that disruptive, because basically your brain will start waking up, you know, when it's exposed to the morning light. So if you can, you know, be sure to, in your home environment where you're sleeping, you really want to make sure that you're in darkness. For example, you know, you want to control the timing of when you eat and exercise, or other, you know, those are sort of light, the timing of light exposure, the timing of meals, and the timing of exercise are all things that can help with this and your adjustment to the different shifts.
Okay, well, thank you so much for the call, Tim. And let's go on to Rick in Grafton. Rick, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? An interesting thing about genetics, because I was wondering with my Scottish background if I always struggle, but every season in Wisconsin, born and raised, I have issues. And what I did a couple weeks ago is I bought a Philips Dawn simulator, and I've had them before and they didn't work that good, but this one, Philips says they did research, and it starts out red, then orange, and then yellow, and I literally, the buzzer never has to go off, and I've been noticing the past couple weeks, and I've struggled for years with this, that I am becoming more alert, and even having an easier time falling asleep at night. You can make it simulate dusk, too. So I wonder if your research has checked into that, and also if DNA, you know, if you come from Europe or something like that, if there seems to be a common DNA of struggling with the hours, the normal hours that other people have.
Okay, thanks a lot, Rick. Appreciate that. And yeah, I've heard of these clocks or whatever that emit light. Do they help?
Yes, they should. You know, some people will be more responsive than others. So you know, it's. But basically, as I mentioned before, this biological clock pays attention to blue wavelength lights, doesn't pay very much attention to red. So they sell now, all these Philips and other companies as well, sell these products, the lighting, that you can just put in your normal fluorescent or, you know, incandescent sort of lighting that then has much more of the blue wavelengths. And for many people, this will help a lot in terms of, you know, helping them wake up and sort of synchronized to that lighting. So, and it is also the case that people that are in the four, you know, more north and more south, where they have, you know, the winter months, which you're just getting started into in Wisconsin, you know, that puts a stress on this circadian system, because many times people are not getting very much light exposure at all. They're getting up and getting to work before the sunlight, you know, and coming back home in the dark as well. And so this, you know, having this natural lighting is a good strategy to sort of help with that.
And so, Chris, as we get ready to wrap up, there are our shift workers, obviously, who are listening and a little concerned about what this may be doing to them. Do you have any final advice for how to tackle this?
Right. A couple of things. The first is don't panic. The good news is that, you know, these negative effects that have been seen with either the central nervous system or with the diabetes or even the breast cancer take usually over a decade to sort of manifest, so you don't see anything before that. And I think the other piece of advice is to be mindful of it, you know, that there are things, there are countermeasures that you can do to make sure that you're getting enough sleep. You can take a short nap, for example, is a very useful countermeasure if you're not getting your 8 hours that you would need. And pay more attention. You probably have to pay more attention to your diet and the amount of exercise that you're getting if you're in a situation where you are working a shift. So the good news is that many people are able to work these shifts without having long-lasting problems.
Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, pleasure.
That was Christopher Colwell. He's a professor of psychiatry and director of the Lab for Circadian and Sleep Medicine at UCLA. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, from the White House to the White Pillars Museum in De Pere, we'll explore a collection of presidential artifacts on display here in the state.
First, with another election victory now in his rearview mirror, Governor Scott Walker is beginning the process of laying out his agenda for his second term. He'll do so with a larger and more conservative Republican majority in the state legislature.
And some of the leaders in the legislature are eager to get started, including Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. In a recent press conference, he laid out his priorities for Assembly Republicans, including tax cuts and an expansion of the state's voucher school program, among other things. Whatever ends up happening, any legislative action will come under closer scrutiny than usual as speculation over Governor Walker's presidential aspirations heats up.
Joining us now to talk about the state's legislative agenda is Mary Spicuzza, state government reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. Mary, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's take a look at the new state legislature. It's the same party in total control, but with a stronger majority this time. How would you describe the new power differential in the state Senate and Assembly?
You know, Speaker Voss was obviously very happy yesterday during his press conference. His majority expanded. They had 60. It looks like they're now going to have 63 seats. But I think the real difference is going to be in the Senate, where they expanded their majority. Republicans now hold 19 compared to the Democrats, 14. So that's going to make a difference in that, you know, before there would be one or two Republicans who didn't support something and they could really block legislation from being passed. Now, with that broader majority, it seems like Republicans really see that a conservative agenda will have virtually no obstacles in its way.
You mentioned some high spirits with Speaker Voss. What's the general mood among state Republicans as they look at their to-do list?
Gosh, it was almost giddy yesterday, I would say. They were, you know, just they obviously are excited about the election results and say they're ready to get back to work. I think things could get very busy here as early January, right after everybody is sworn in and they're going to take off for the next session. Speaker Voss is, you know, he really has already like a, you know, his written list. They were calling it the Assembly Republicans' plans for going forward. They put out a packet of quite a few details, drug testing for benefits, overhauling the GAB. We're still not entirely sure what that's going to look like, changing the how secret John Doe investigations are conducted. Obviously, they want to continue pushing for tax cuts, both income tax and property tax cuts. But he really laid out quite a number of things that they want to tackle among Assembly Republicans. Senate Republicans were still waiting to hear. I asked Senate Majority Fitzgerald about it yesterday, and he said that he really wanted to meet with his caucus to talk with them about their priorities, especially because they have so many new members. So he really didn't want to lay out an agenda, but Speaker Voss is pretty clear that he is ready to go.
Now, I want to get your take on a recent quote from Governor Walker. He said, "We're going to be even more aggressive now." And some analysts would look at, you know, the past couple of years and say he's been rather aggressive. If you look at the Act 10 legislation, for instance, what do you think a statement like that signals for what's ahead?
You know, I think in terms of school vouchers, for example, there were Republicans who took issue with just kind of unlimited school vouchers. Senator Ellis was clearly one of them. With him gone, I think that conservatives really feel like You know, even if there is a Republican or two who doesn't want to see that expansion happen unlimited, that it really won't matter because they'll have enough of a majority anyway. So I think that they are really seeing this as they can now move forward, and there really isn't going to be a lot stopping them or even slowing it down.
Now, the state's going to be dealing with a budget shortfall, it looks like, and that's probably what state legislators are going to have to tackle first. What do we know so far about how they're planning to get a handle on that, on the budget deficit?
You know, I think, again, Speaker Voss, Governor Walker have both said that they feel like that is just a projection, that $1.8 billion budget shortfall, that they feel like that's assuming there's not going to be any growth. They seem to be confident that there is going to be growth, and so have been, I don't want to say dismissive, but have made it clear that they're not too concerned that that $1.8 billion is going to come to pass. I guess we'll just have to wait and see, but I think Democrats have pointed to that as a sign that things are going to need to change and that they have some concerns going forward.
Now, you mentioned briefly some of the initiatives that the GOP is going to be looking at in the state. One of these is from Governor Walker. He said during his campaign he'd like to start drug testing for people who are getting public benefits. Is that one that you see being on the top of the list?
I do. Speaker Voss mentioned it. Governor Walker's mentioned it several times. In his victory speech the other night, he talked about wanting to move people from government dependence to true independence, and he feels like drug issues might be standing in the way of people getting jobs. I think critics would say that it's more of a punitive measure, but we'll really have to wait and see how he wants to implement it. It has been blocked elsewhere. A judge in Florida found it to be unconstitutional, and so we'll have to get some details about how he wants to implement that in a way that it wouldn't just be immediately blocked by the courts.
There's also been growing discontentment about the Common Core among Republicans. What kind of action do you expect to see in that area coming up?
You know, I think that what we're going to see is they've talked about replacing Common Core with educational standards that were developed in Wisconsin. There's a lot of critics of Common Core among Republicans and conservatives, and I think that we're going to pretty quickly see a move to try to replace Common Core with other educational standards.
Speaker Voss has also talked about reforming the Government Accountability Board, as you mentioned a little while ago, and changing also how John Doe investigations in the state are handled. Do you have a rough idea of what Speaker Voss has in mind about that?
You know, before the elections, it really sounded like he wanted to have Kevin Kennedy fired as quickly as possible, and basically it sounded like it was going to be a pretty dramatic overhaul of the Government Accountability Board. It seems like, I don't want to say that he backed away from those statements, but they did not seem as pointed yesterday in his press conference. So I'm not sure if they're still working out the details of how, you know, what they want to see changed at the Government Accountability Board. He said that he feels like it isn't as nonpartisan as it should be, that obviously Republicans and conservatives were pretty unhappy with the way the John Doe investigations have been conducted. And but I think we're trying to get some details right now of what Republican leaders want to see differently at those agencies.
Now, as a lot of analysts are saying, Governor Walker looks to be poising himself to be a presidential contender in 2016. What does that mean about the line he may have to walk between balancing what's best for the state and what will get the most attention for a presidential bid?
Yeah, I think that's certainly something that many, many people will be watching. I think that he's going to be under a pretty bright spotlight over these next coming months until people know whether he's running or not. I'm expecting a lot of will he or won't he stories coming out. I think that, you know, certainly his critics are concerned and have said that they are worried he's going to be thinking more about a presidential bid and what will look good for appealing to national conservatives than doing what's best for Wisconsin. Certainly his supporters would disagree and say, you know, he is solely motivated by trying to make Wisconsin better, and that he, you know, other people are only naming him because he's been so successful here, and that they want to see that success brought to Washington. So I think this is going to be one of those partisan splits, and I don't think they're going to agree on what his motivations are.
Okay, Mary, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Mary Spacuzza, state government reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. She joined us to talk about the state legislature's upcoming agenda for the next term. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. If you're looking for an up-close experience with presidential history, look no further than De Pere, Wisconsin. Today on Curious Wisconsin, we're looking at a collection of letters from the Founding Fathers and some china from the Lincoln-era White House on display at the White Pillars Museum in De Pere.
The exhibition is called From the White House to White Pillars. The artifacts remain in the area thanks to a campaign by the Green Bay De Pere Antiquarian Society that raised $1.3 million in 2007 to buy them from the library and prevent them from being sold at auction.
Adam Stick is the director of the White Pillars Museum in De Pere. He joins us now to talk about the collection. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So how did you come by this treasure trove of presidential artifacts?
Well, the De Pere Historical Society has always had a very cooperative relationship with the Green Bay De Pere Antiquarian Society, and while we were talking about this and that, and they mentioned that the letters were here, that they had the letters, that they would like to exhibit them, and we had some exhibit space, and it seemed like a wonderful opportunity to help us both. And in addition to that, the Lincoln china.
And how rare are these items?
You do find presidential letters. To the best of my knowledge, these are the only ones in the area. So we're very happy to have them here. You find in private collections and in museums across the country, you do find examples of the Lincoln china. But again, this is the only museum in this area right now featuring an exhibit like this.
Can you tell us exactly what it is you have?
What we have are two wonderful plates of the Lincoln pattern. It was quite a bit of work to authenticate these, and what we found as we worked on this actually with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library in Springfield, and what we discovered as we were researching this was that one of the plates we are very sure is not actually of the Lincoln administration. It's the exact same pattern, the exact same maker, but due to the maker's mark on the back, we can tell it was actually probably created during the Harrison administration a few years later.
Now, can you tell us a little bit about the original Lincoln china? What's the history there?
Every president, they order their own particular pattern of china. You can go to museums in Washington, D.C., where they have exhibits of all the different presidents. And the particular pattern, it's beautiful. It's purple with gold glint with an eagle in the center holding arrows. And this is what was ordered by Mary Todd Lincoln.
And is it intact, in good condition?
Both plates, we have a large dinner plate. That is the one that we feel very strongly is of the Harrison administration. And we have a small dessert plate with no maker's mark on the back, so that one we're not quite sure of. But they are both in pristine condition. The antiquarians also offered us a reproduction of the Lincoln china, which is also on exhibit. So you can tell the very distinct difference between the 19th century china and the modern day reproductions.
Now, presidents face a lot of decisions when they come into office, Lincoln maybe more so than most. What's the process of picking out the presidential china like?
Well, there's a whole story that goes along with this because Mary Todd was well known for spending a lot of money in furnishing the White House. In particular, during the time of the Civil War, she really tried to create a showcase mansion to show the awesomeness of the presidency. So this particular china, it's very well known, probably among the more beautiful patterns picked by any president.
Is this something that still goes on today? Presidents, whoever enters the White House, they're picking out china?
Oh, yes. Every president gets their own pattern.
And they don't register for it, though, at the local store, right?
Not exactly.
They get the whole kit right up front.
Yes, these are custom designed for the president.
Now, you also have seven presidential letters on display, and where are those from?
We have letters dating from John Adams, from Thomas Jefferson, from James Madison, James Monroe, John Quincy Adams, one from Andrew Jackson, and then one from Grover Cleveland.
Were these all part of the same collection of presidential letters, or are they kind of a little bit here, a little bit there?
I believe the antiquarians purchased those all together.
And what is the content of these letters?
The letters are really fascinating, and particularly of the early presidents, because they're all correspondence between these former presidents and a Philadelphia bookseller named Joseph de la Plaine.
And why was this bookseller so interested in corresponding with these ex-presidents?
All of these letters pertain to the same topic. Mr. Delaplane is asking the former presidents for either a memoir of themselves for his own collection or a portrait of themselves for his own collection. And all of the presidents very politely refuse him.
Well, why did they even take the time to respond to someone like that personally?
I was curious as to who Mr. Delaplane was, and in cross-matching against the listings that Monticello has, they have extensive listings of all of President Jefferson's correspondents. He had a steady correspondence with Mr. Delaplane. So it seems to be very much like we order things online in lots. They were purchasing books from this gentleman in Philadelphia.
Oh, so he was actually selling books to Jefferson and other former presidents?
That is certainly what it seems like, yes.
Okay, so he wasn't just some random crank trying to get free stuff.
Oh, no, absolutely not. In all the letters, and essentially the same way, they had a relationship with him, and they all end, "with respect and my regards to you, sir." So clearly this is not them just answering fan mail, you could say. This is somebody they had a relationship with.
It must be fascinating to look at these letters and the different penmanship of all the presidents. You've got a sampling of some of the greatest men in American history. Is there anything that you can tell us just about how they look, what the penmanship is like?
Some of my favorites here, I love the John Adams letter because what he relays back to Mr. Delaplane is that there are people selling my likeness who I've never met, much less sat for. He particularly mentions a Catholic priest who he met very briefly, and then the next thing he knew, this gentleman sold something like 20,000 likenesses of him, and he's very clear in the end of the letter, he didn't get a cut of it at all.
Now, how are these displayed at the museum? Can we actually lean in and read these in a case or something?
Oh, yes, you can lean in. Right, I'm looking at the case right now, and what I also did was I transcribed the letters because some of these are a bit difficult to read. In particular, the Jackson letter is very difficult to read. I understood that once I transcribed it, it's written within a year of his death to his friend Mary Gardner, and he particularly mentions his ailing health.
And what does he say about how he's doing?
He says that his health is ailing and that he is very happy to still have a friendship with this lady.
Do any of the ex-presidents here give any indication of their thoughts on the politics and where the nation has gone since their time in office?
There's really not a great deal of that. It's much more personal correspondence with Mr. Delaplane, which makes for a really interesting look into the later lives of these presidents.
Now, you said you transcribed these letters, which must have been an honor. How do you do that without damaging them? Just procedurally, how does one go about doing that?
The letters are all encased in UV-protected frames, so they're protected from sunlight. And what I also did was I made digital images of them so that I could refine the handwriting as I needed to. My background in particular is in 18th and 17th century history, so I'm used to reading this kind of writing.
So we've been talking about this exhibition of presidential materials. What kind of other things do we see at the White Pillars Museum?
Oh, we have a great deal of things here on exhibit. We have a wonderful exhibit pertaining to Terry Musin, our own Miss America, Terry Musin, Miss America 1973. We do have her crown on permanent exhibit here. We have a magnificent digital archive, so you can come here and research all manners of Brown County history through our digital computer system, which is very unique. You don't find anything like this really in most of the state of Wisconsin.
Now, some people who get so up close and personal with history report feeling sort of a kinship either with the person whose items that they're looking at or kind of a high, just this connection with history. Did you feel that as you were, dealing with this china or reading and transcribing these letters?
I had to say once I first handled these Lincoln plates, and it was really fascinating to think, to picture Lincoln eating stew one night, drafting the Gettysburg Address while eating off one of these plates, which probably wasn't the case, but it's that very much that kind of, like you said, kinship that you feel in just handling these sort of things. And just getting a peek, beyond the presidency and the revolution, just into a little bit of the private lives of these men through these letters is just fascinating and really a privilege for me.
And what's the response been from visitors to the museum seeing the letters and the china?
Oh, we have people come in and they're absolutely fascinated by these. They love that they're here. The clear question we get a great deal is people have trouble reading them, which is why I do have transcriptions available for people to read and kind of match up the old handwriting with just kind of modern-day script.
Do you have any plans to try to sort of complete the set, get other pieces of presidential china, perhaps more letters?
Not at this time. Even going through these were not easy to authenticate. And they're in private collections all across the country. And right now, we're very pleased with what we've got here.
And Adam, is there a part of American history that particularly stokes your interest?
My area of interest is actually in pre-revolutionary history, mm-hmm. when many of these men were very young in their careers, kind of like I am now. So really that's where my background in my research has pertained, is pre-revolutionary history, which is really the history of De Pere in many ways. This is the oldest European community in Wisconsin, comes from Rapide de Pere. This is where the first Jesuit mission was set up in 1671.
All right. Well, thank you, Adam, so much for joining us and sharing these artifacts with us.
Thank you very much.
That's Adam Stick. He's director of the White Pillars Museum here in De Pere, Wisconsin, talking about the museum's exhibit of presidential history on display now.